There's a dream. Someone comes to the Buddha. This is recorded in the middle length discourses. And in the dream, there's a smoking anthill. And then in the dream, the person starts digging into the anthill and then finds all these things, finds a, I forget what they are, but like maybe a hammer, a chisel, or pot, you know, all these, a whole bunch of series of things. And each time they find something in the dream, they throw it out. And they keep digging deeper and deeper into the anthill. Until at some point, digging into it, the person finds a snake. And then the snake is left alone. You don't throw that snake away. And so the person goes to the Buddha, explains this dream, and the Buddha interprets the dream and says, well, the anthill, the smoking anthill, is our psychophysical being. And you kind of go and dig into the psychophysical being, see who you are, and you come across these different aspects of who we are. And there's a bar at some point, like a bar in front of a door, keeping a door locked. And that bar is the hindrances, and you throw away the hindrances, and you throw all the stuff. But when you get down to the bottom, there's a snake. And that snake you don't let go of, you don't throw away. And I'm not sure what the snake symbolizes in this story. I don't remember the story so well. But there's something you don't let go of. And a snake, in many situations in Indian religions, sometimes symbolizes strength, certain kind of power, like kundalini. It's often indicated like a snake. And the idea of strength and power. When the Buddha, after the Buddha was enlightened, there is a story of a snake wrapping itself around the Buddha and then putting its cobra hood over the top of the Buddha's head like an umbrella and protecting the Buddha from the rain. And I have a statue at home, a little wooden statue of this snake, you know, all wrapped around the base of the Buddha and then this cobra head going up. And here we have this again, this image of this symbol of strength, of power, connected with the Buddha. In front of Zen monastery gates, there's often these guardian deities that are there guarding the Dharma. Their job is to guard the Dharma. They're ferocious. You know, they have this, they often have suits of armor on, and they have swords, and they take these warrior poses, you know, like, you know, and their faces are kind of, you know, serious faces, ferocious faces. You know, they're not kind and filled with loving kindness and acceptance. They're like, you know, if you want to go through these gates, you know, you got to deal with me, thus first. And, you know, they're keeping the evil spirits away or something. So there's a number of ways in Buddhism where there's kind of some emphasis then on this energetic quality of strength and power. You find it more in the technical teachings in the Seven Factors of Awakening, and that those are divided into basically two camps. The mindfulness is not in either camp, but one category is those three factors that have to do with, that are calming factors. And then there's three other factors which are arousing factors. And the three calming factors are things like concentration, tranquility, and equanimity. The arousing factors, the energizing factors, are investigation, energy, effort, strength, and joy. It's kind of to fill in the montage of all this, you want to remember that the Buddha came from a warrior class. He was a warrior. He'd been trained to be a warrior. And some of the images in the early suttas are warrior images. That someone, the English, I'm not so sure of, you gird yourself, is that the expression? You gird yourself with your armor. That's when you put your armor on. And so you gird yourself with your determination to practice. You put on this armor, you know, it's like this strong image. And And some of the emphasis on self-respect that seems to be in the early tradition, they don't use that word, is the kind of self-respect that a warrior would have. A warrior, you know, traditional, classic, or archetypical warrior, doesn't want to do anything that would somehow violate or denigrate some kind of powerful sense of self-worth and self-respect that's already there. Of course I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't lie, because lying just, you know, I'm, I have this self-respect, this strength. So I say all this because in the language, in the teachings that I've encountered, in the teachings I've taught here in the West, often the teachings focus on the calming factors of meditation rather than the arousing factors. I think it's because there's a great need in our culture for dealing with stress. You know, people are so hyper in this culture and so going so fast. And also people in this culture sometimes are very strive a lot and are pushing a lot. Sometimes they have too much energy in practice, and they're kind of striving some way that makes it difficult for them. And so there's a lot of language of calming, of relaxing. And there's also a lot of language of acceptance. Accept what's going on, be with it, accept it, be kind to it, be here with it. And a little bit, it's a very powerful, important teaching for our culture. A little bit, it's a compensation or a counter to kind of an overly aggressive mode of practicing or being that people sometimes in the West have had. And so they needed to have the balance of acceptance and be calm and have loving kindness. But if the pendulum, if a compensatory teaching takes the pendulum and swings it too far, so there's a, and then become imbalanced in the other direction. And I think sometimes there's a tendency in our kind of scene for people to focus too much on the calming aspects of meditation, the de-stressing aspects, the accepting aspects, the let's be kind aspect of what's going on. And the aspect of ferocity, or the strength or power that, of a warrior, for example, isn't spoken much. In fact, I've been afraid to talk about the warrior attitude in practice, partly because I'm a man, and I know that people just, it's so masculine and then I've gone to these taught retreats with other teachers, and it turns out it's the women teachers who talk about being a warrior. Well, they can do it. I can't do it in this kind of culture, I'd get my head chopped off. But there is this aspect of Buddhism of touching in or finding a sense of strength. And strength has, as I said this morning, has two aspects in relation to practice. There's a strength of applying ourselves in practice, which has to do with kind of efforting, making the effort. And often that's kind of, you arouse yourself to make effort, you apply yourself, you have determination, resolve, and you're kind of doing something. And often, sometimes overriding laziness, overriding fear, overriding whatever is going on, but you kind of apply yourself, which sometimes is wise and sometimes not. And there's another kind of strength, which is not the strength of applying yourself, but the strength of kind of being vital, certain vitality, a tremendous sense of vitality and aliveness kind of coursing through us. If you go to the gym, or some exercise like that, and you finish the exercising, sometimes you feel all this energy coursing through you, this aliveness, this energy, this heat, this whatever it is. And the sense of power and well-being is kind of goes with us for 5 minutes after the gym, or for some time, right? And a lot of things can happen right after being at the gym or the equivalent, and it doesn't seem to affect us as much because we have all this vitality coursing through us. It's like just bounces right off. Someone tells you that your mother wears army boots, it's not going to affect you much. If you have to come out of the gym, it's like, get out of my way. I'm a bulldozer. I couldn't care less. But then sometimes you feel kind of deflated and sad, and life's not going well, and you've been accepting things too much, And someone tells you that your mother wears army boots, and maybe you get aroused, in fact, you get angry, or maybe you just be more deflated, and you interpret being more deflated as a kind of acceptance. I'm being so accepting. There's a place in practice for strength, for this vitality, this inner fire that can exist. There's a word in Sanskrit, Smita, if you don't mind me asking you.
Virya,
but tapas. What does tapas mean for you?
Tapas, I think, comes from heat.
Heat. And what does it colloquially mean?
Tap.
So?
Tap.
Tap, yeah.
What I mean, in Marathi. I'm Hindi. Okay.
What does it mean? Heat?
Marathi and Gujarati is tap.
But
tap is heat.
Heat. So just use, because it means used any other way, the word.
For an angry person. Marathi tap.
For an angry person. Because in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha describes.
There's also tap. I don't know if tap comes from. Is that in religion? Tap is intensive meditation practices, but very, very intensive.
Very intensive. So like raising the inner heat and things like that.
Perhaps.
So the word in the Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha gave the instructions for meditation, he talked about the quality that to bring to the meditation is tapas, and he didn't mean to be angry. It's translated into English usually as ardent, to be ardent, and I'm not sure what ardent means, you know, in terms of the etymology of the word, but there's a kind of quality of the tapas, heat, of fire. Vitality, you know, this inner fire. Some people feel, you know, you feel like this inner fire in your belly, for example. And
I have a related to determination. So if there's a difference in meditation and tapas, so if Rishi was doing tapas, then Indra would get very upset because he thought he could be dethroned by somebody who was that determined.
Ah.
He could become the god of the gods, and so he always sent in, you know, distractions. But not for a person who is just doing meditation, but for some of the tapas, so much that you can conquer the world.
Ah, isn't that great? So if that's a myth...
Mara's army was sent for the people who...
So if that's a myth, if you use kind of, you know, kind of a Jungian thing on myth, right? Then are there four, you know, if we're going to develop our strength, is there aspects in our psyche that says, no, you know, I can't be a god, I can't be strong, I don't count, I can't take up space, you know, I have to be kind of sit in the back of the room and kind of not count, or you know, or somehow there's something wrong with kind of taking a stand or being fully here. Is there something frightening about kind of having strength? I know a lot of people are afraid of their strength, afraid of making an impact of something in their lives. So the word for strength in Pali is virya, and you're not supposed to mention this in Western Buddhist circles, because it gives the wrong impression. So you never hear this, what I'm about to tell you. The word virya is cognate to the Latin word virile, because of the way Indo-European languages are connected. So we're not supposed to say that, because I don't know, not sure why, but more of this, you know, kind of overly masculine form of Buddhism. So, you know, the pendulum swings back and forth, and the point, you know, is not, you know, the point is to find the middle where things come into balance. But in order for things to be balanced, it's not balanced because one side is let go of or dampened. It's balanced because both sides are actually quite strong. So to have a tremendous strength and a capacity to be accepting, to be loving, have loving kindness, a strength and a capacity to be equanimous, a strength and a capacity to be accepting, partnered with, connected with other kinds of strength, strength of determination, strength of will, we'd say here in the West, strength of determination, a strength of many kinds of strengths, but not just strengths of something, but just a sense of strength, a sense of power that has no channel, has no, you know, reason. It's just, you know, you just feel, you know, like when you leave the gym, you feel strong perhaps, but there's no reason for it. I mean, there's a cause for it, but it's just there, right? You're not being asked to be strong for any purpose. It just carries you down the street as you walk down the street. So to be strong. And so you might think about it a little bit. And see, it's a very important quality of practice, virya. There's a lot to be said about it. And it's worthwhile, once in a great while, to highlight this aspect of the practice and to reflect a little bit, you know, can it be a support and support an aid for your practice to carry your practice forward and support it? If you don't avail yourself of your strength, then you're probably shortchanging yourself in both your meditation practice, but also in your daily life, you know? And if other people are afraid of your strength, then that's a whole other topic. So, those are my thoughts for this morning.